A happy Monday morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. This hour, it's All Things Political as we're joined by Marvin Overby, professor and chair in political science at the University of Missouri. This week, this morning rather, we'll be talking about the healthcare reform push this week and whether or not the Democrats have the votes and what the outcomes will mean for both parties. Also, tension in the Middle East and education reform, a couple of topics out there that we can talk about this morning. Also, anything else that's on your mind in the political spectrum. We always love to hear what you have to say, and you can give us a ring at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Marvin Overby, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Good morning.
Well, this is a big week for the Obama administration, the week of the big final healthcare push. Do you think we're going to see a vote?
I think we will. I think the outcome of the vote remains a bit in doubt. But I, as a student of the Congress, I think that someone like Speaker Pelosi is not going to bring this vote up unless she believes she can, at the end of the day, get the necessary votes to get her to 218. We'll see. She's a very good vote counter. She's been, I think, a very good speaker. I think even her enemies will admit that she is good at getting what she wants out of the House of Representatives. So it's going to be interesting to watch.
As far as the head counting goes, any idea where Democrats stand? It sounds like they're feeling confident.
Yeah, you get sort of mixed messages. Jim Clyburn, the chief whip for the Democrats this weekend, was saying they didn't have the votes yet. I think it's reasonable to assume that if they were sure they had the votes, they would bring the vote up sooner rather than later. But there are all sorts of, different dynamics going on here. Once the leadership indicates that they are willing to make some deals and to offer either direct or indirect payments, quote unquote, for votes, then the bar is open, and people who, at the end of the day, are likely to vote for the bill, it's in their best interest maybe to indicate that they're wavering a bit. And I think we've seen that with some members of the Congressional Black Caucus, some members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, people who are in all likelihood going to vote for the bill. Showing a little bit of reluctance to say that out loud right now. And they're likely to be able to get a little bit of the speaker's time, a little bit of the president's time, and maybe get something that they would like in exchange, quote-unquote, for that vote.
And do you think we're going to see the reconciliation process go into effect?
I assume so. I don't think there's any way of getting this measure passed into law now without some version of the reconciliation process going through. That, as people who have been following the story know, complicates the matter. It requires the House to sort of, House members to sort of hold their breath and jump off sort of a legislative cliff with the understanding that the Senate is going to do what they said they would do and make subsequent changes to the bill after the president has signed it into law. And, there's a good deal of distrust in Washington generally, on Capitol Hill more specifically, and between the House and the Senate probably most explicitly. So we're likely to see reconciliation, but it's not going to be a particularly fun process to watch, I think.
Right. It's been such fun so far.
Like, well, laws or sausage, you don't want to watch either one being made.
Exactly. Well, if let's assume that the vote does go through and that the Democrats have the votes, how big a victory is this for the Democrats? Is it a real victory, or is it kind of one with a bitter aftertaste?
Oh, boy, that's a complicated question, and I'm not sure there's an easy answer to it. It is going to be a victory of sorts. It's probably going to be a victory more in the long run than in the short run. I suspect there are going to be some Democrats who will vote for this bill who may well pay a political price for it in the fall midterm elections. I think in the long run, the Democratic Party is probably better off passing this bill than not passing it. If they were to go into the fall elections with a majority of Democratic members having supported a bill, but then that bill never got passed, it's sort of the worst of both worlds. I believe the leadership and probably most House and Senate Democrats think they're in a better position if they actually get the bill passed, so they can at least be able to say, you know, we were able to accomplish something in 2009 and 2010 that has been on the agenda of both Republican and Democratic administrations since essentially for 110 years. And I believe they think that's in their long-term best interest. I've said it before on the show, and I believe it to be true. I think once you get health care reforms like are being discussed now into place, they become relatively popular with the public. So like Social Security, like Medicare, like Medicaid, these matters become reasonably popular with the public, and I think that redounds probably to the long-term interest of the Democratic Party, although in the short term, as I say, there are going to be some Democrats who are going to pay an electoral price for this.
So even though, according to a lot of the polling we've seen, this is an unpopular measure, you think that once it's passed, people are going to realize its worth?
I think so. And I think you need to be careful interpreting those polling numbers. And this is where you get the parties bickering back and forth with each other. Republicans generally are correct in that more people in the American public disapprove of this bill when asked about it than approve. But Democrats are correct when they say that when you take individual items in this measure, such as extending health care to 30 million additional people or allowing greater coverage of children into their 20s, those measures similarly poll very popularly, right? They are supported by relatively large majorities of the American people. I checked on a website called pollster.com that readers may be familiar with, listeners may be familiar with, and they show right now that if you average the polls taken in the last 4 or 5 weeks, that 48% of the American public oppose and 44% favor this bill. So I think the notion that this is a grossly unpopular bill has been exaggerated.
Let's go to our first phone call here. We have Jeff with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I'm really looking forward to this week politically for this healthcare vote because I think a lot of people voted for Obama and the Democratic majorities to get things like this done and deliver on their promises. And having said that, somehow I think even if it does pass, the Republicans will still take credit for it.
Marvin, over me.
I doubt if the Republicans will take credit for it in the short term. You know, 10, 15 years down the road, if it passes, they will probably try to blur the partisan difference in this. But I think that in the short term, in the 2010 elections, they are going to try to play up the unpopular aspects of the bill, try to play up and link it to other unpopular aspects of the Obama administration and the Congress, that it took too long to get passed, that it's a mishmash, that it's going to likely contribute to the budget deficit in the short term, if not in the long term. I doubt if they're going to go out there and say this is our bill and we take credit for it. They're going to try to tie this like a millstone around the necks of many vulnerable Democrats.
Well, and if it passes and the Democrats get their votes, can the Democrats really be sure that this is what they need to shore up the fall elections? Or, you know, are the Democrats going to be too mad about losing the public option?
I think only some Democrats are going to be mad about losing the public option. 2010 is shaping up to be a generically good year for Republicans, just like 2006 and 2008 were generically good year for Democrats. But I don't think Democrats should be panicking yet about the situation. I saw Tom Brokaw on Meet the Press, I believe, this weekend, pointing to numbers about the level of unemployment in the early 1980s and how popular Ronald Reagan and to a large extent, congressional Republicans remained, even in the face of unemployment rates that were considerably higher than they are right now. So I think there's this tendency on the part of some Democrats to sort of panic right now about the situation. But there are indicators that things may be turning a bit. Things may not be quite as bleak as they looked for Democratic fortunes 2 or 3 weeks ago or 2 or 3 months ago. Passage of a major health care reform bill, I think, is something that is going to play well in some areas. It's something that the Democratic candidates, at least in some parts of the country, can point to as an accomplishment. And we could talk about sort of other things I see out there on the political horizon that make me think that as in the words of Missouri native Mark Twain, that the death of the Democratic Party may have been exaggerated.
Well, I want to get at that from a different angle. I was thinking, as I heard you talk about the bad year for Democrats, the generically good year for Republicans in the next election, it wasn't that long ago that we were reading the New York Times and reading articles about the death of the Republican Party. I mean, wasn't even they're going to get hammered in the next election. It was sort of more from the angle that Republicans were going to be obsolete. What happened to that?
I guess my cynical response to that is that's what journalists get paid to do, is to sell newspapers, and you don't sell newspapers by nuanced stories about how there's these things sort of ebb and flow over time, and that. But you sell newspapers by more hysterical or histrionic headlines that say, you know, this party's collapsing or that party is collapsing. I think the broad truth in American politics is that we see sort of long-term waves of these things. And we are, by virtue of the nature of our society and the nature of our electoral system, essentially a two-party system. And you're going to see those parties sort of wax and wane. And we've seen that waxing and waning can take place now within just the course of a couple of years. So I think that... I don't think that serious Democratic or Republican operatives believe that the Republican Party was on the brink of collapse a couple of years ago, and I don't think serious Democratic operatives believe the Democratic Party is going to do the same now.
But if the health care reform push fails, does that cast serious doubt on the rest of Obama's term and the Democrats' ability to lead?
It does, again, at least in the short term, right? We have these periodic elections that tend to reinvigorate the system with sometimes, you know, with one ineffective side being pushed out for what the people hope will be a more effective side. But, yeah, the Obama administration has raised the stakes on this. To use the sort of term of the era, they have gone all in, using that poker term. And that raises the stakes. It helps the president in some ways. He can now call wavering Democrats into the Oval Office and say, look, we're all in on this. I don't think you want to go down in Democratic Party history as being one of the people who sort of scuttled my presidency. And that can be a powerful argument. As any number of members of Congress have found out over the years when they're called into the Oval Office, it's a hard place to argue with the president. And the president also has, and also the House leadership and Senate leadership too, have certain goodies they can offer in exchange. It's one thing to say that you're not going to vote for the president. It's another thing to say that you're not going to vote for the president when he offers you something for that vote. Mm. And oftentimes those are side payments. It's you know, what economists would call side payments. It's sort of an understanding that if you vote for me, help me with this, I will do what I can to help you raise money in your district to run for re-election. And if you fail in that run for re-election, you know, I'm the president. I can find something for you in the administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're heading into break, but let's take one more call first. We've got Ray with us from New London. Hey, Ray.
How you doing? My biggest problem with this bill is the fact that it's unconstitutional due to the fact that there is no interstate commerce. The Democrats won't allow it so that insurance companies can compete from one state to another. So there goes the interstate commerce clause. And because the interstate commerce clause doesn't apply, anything that is not spelled out in the Constitution for the federal government to do is left to the various states. All the various states have, we have badger care. Every single state has a state-ran program. Even though I disagree with that, I don't mind it because I believe constitutionally that's the way it should be. I've contacted both my senators and my representative in regards to this. I've asked them to write me letters. They are totally non-responsive, and I've called Representative Kagan four times to get him to write me and tell me what his thinking is on this, and just total totally not responsive, but I'm sure I'm going to be getting all these letters of how great they are doing for their campaigning on my dime. And then finally, why isn't a majority of the news media letting people know that they're not going to get this health care for 3 to 4 years, but they're going to be taxed on it almost immediately? And then finally, what do the Democrats think about the fact that since they're going to be doing this reconciliation, which is totally not what it's for, when the Republicans get back into control, maybe they'll just start using reconciliation to pass everything that they want.
Okay, we've got a three-pronged question there from Ray. Why don't you take a stab at that before our break, Marvin Overby?
I'll try. It's a complicated question, and there are some complicated issues involved in there. Let's talk first about interstate commerce. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution lays out what the Congress can do, and it says explicitly that Congress has responsibility for regulating interstate commerce. That has been interpreted very broadly by the courts over the years, beginning back with John Marshall in 1819, I believe. And so there is actually, in any sort of health care, a good bit of this, what Marshall called the stream of commerce across the state lines. If you have doctors who are educated in one state and practice in another state, if you have drugs that are produced in one state and transported across state lines into another state, if you have hospitals that have hospital corporations that have hospitals in multiple jurisdictions across state lines, all of that, any of that, would trigger what the Supreme Court and the federal courts have traditionally thought of as the ability of the federal government through the Congress to regulate that. So the fact that this particular bill doesn't allow people to buy health insurance across state lines doesn't nullify the fact that health care is an interstate business. And so that alone, that's all Congress needs, I think, to be able to regulate this. I don't think there is really any chance that the federal courts are going to rule a bill that's passed in its entirety unconstitutional because of the Interstate Commerce Clause. I think that's a fundamental misreading of what the Constitution says. In terms of the responsiveness of legislators in Wisconsin or other places, they have heard a lot from constituents about this. I believe they believe that they have made their positions known generally, and I'm not sure they see a whole lot more utility sometimes in terms of arguing about these matters or necessarily explaining themselves about these matters until perhaps we see the final vote on this as it goes forward. In terms of reconciliation, I'm not really sure what to make of this. The public seems to get very upset when we have procedures in place that require a supermajority of senators to get anything done. But you also get members of the public who get very upset when the House and Senate leadership find some creative way to try to get the Senate to work under sort of normal majoritarian conditions. So I'm sure that a lot of people in the Senate leadership feel they're rather damned if they do and damned if they don't on these matters. I do think that the caller had a point, is that every time there is some creative use of these rules of some sort, it benefits not just the party in power, but the party that's next going to be in power. You are going to see the same Republicans who are screaming about the use of reconciliation here, assuming they get control of the Senate in the next couple of election cycles. They will be finding clever and creative ways to use reconciliation to get through what they want. I don't think necessarily there's a matter of principle here on the part of either parties. They're looking for ways to get policy matters through, and they're willing to be rather creative with the rules sometimes.
Well, and former President Bush used reconciliation a bit, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. It is one of those measures that can be used creatively by the majority. That's why you want to be in the majority. You have the ability to sort of craft how these rules are used.
Okay, well, let's take our break right now, and then we'll come back, take more of your phone calls, and keep talking politics this morning with our guest, Marvin Overby, professor and chair in political science at the University of Missouri. Well, we'd love to hear your questions and comments this morning about what's going on out there in the political world. You can give us a ring at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's an All Things Political Monday morning. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn, as we talk with Marvin Overby, professor and chair in political science at the University of Missouri. And we'll take our next phone call here from Dave calling from Menominee. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Thanks. You know, I grabbed the phone because of the interstate, the gentleman who called before with his concerns. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe this guy just isn't listening to regular news, and possibly only just right-wing news, because I think everybody knows that, you know, if we let insurance companies, if we're able to buy over state lines, the insurance companies are just going to puddle together in one state that has the least regulation, and then I'm up here, and I can buy from, say, Utah. Let's say everybody can buy from Utah. Everybody could buy from one state that has the least regulation. I can't move to a state. It's real easy for an insurance company to just uplift and go to a state that has the least regulation. And I think we need to talk a little bit more about the tax exemptions. And also the reconciliation I wanted to bring up. 2001, 2003, this reconciliation was used, you know, and for some reason, it was rammed through back then, but, you know, right-wing media didn't bring it up, so nobody got upset. And another thing is, this bill, maybe this past caller doesn't know, the bill has already passed the House. The bill has already passed the Senate. It's already been through. All it has to do is go back to the House, get passed, and this health care bill is not going to be passed through reconciliation. It's a little, that bill has to be signed into law by the president first, according to the parliamentarian, and then some fixes can come in later. Those will be brought in through reconciliation. And I think people are just being misled on the right, that they're being told that this whole entire bill is being rammed through with reconciliation, and that is an absolute lie. And I'd like to get your guest thoughts on that.
All right, thank you for the call, Dave. You did a good job of explaining the process as it's happening, what needs to happen anyway. Marvin Overby?
Well, the last caller was right in that a bill has been passed by the House and a bill has been passed by the Senate. But the Constitution essentially requires that the Congress pass the same bill. And that's what this reconciliation process is going to be used for. There, you know, there remain some differences between the House and the Senate versions, and it is unclear that through sort of the more or less normal practice of a conference committee, through process of accession probably between the houses, that you would be able to get enough votes, especially in the Senate, to be able to pass a bill, if assuming you need the 60 vote majority to essentially foreclose a filibuster, and that's why reconciliation is being used here, because it as a matter of rule lowers the majority needed to 51, and that means that the Democrats could lose 7-8 votes in the Senate and still be able to pass the bill, especially if you consider that if you know a tie, Vice President Biden's going to come in and vote on it. But you know the issue here, or one of the issues we haven't really touched all that much on, is that this requires a good bit of faith on the part of House members who, as sort of a genetic trait, do not think very highly of the Senate or senators, and it's going to require them to vote on a bill that will then essentially be signed into law with the promise that the Senate will then go back and fix the things that a majority of the House thinks should be fixed. And, you know, that requires at least a little bit of a leap of faith.
Do you think there is the ramming it through aspect?
You know, it depends, again, what you think ramming it through is. And this is a matter, I think, on which people don't necessarily have principles involved so much as they do have politics. The same people who are claiming this is being rammed through, as the previous caller suggested, were perfectly willing to use the reconciliation process, 51 Republican votes, to push through budgetary matters back in the back in the last administration, and we're seriously talking about using a 51 vote majority in the Senate to confirm federal judicial nominations. So I don't think they have necessarily a principle stand that you should have 60 votes for everything. It's just that in this case, their politics lead them to make the argument that the Democrats should have 60 votes to pass this piece of legislation.
Let's go now to Scott with us from New Glarus. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've heard the Republicans saying they're going to do everything they can to slow this down and to make it difficult and all kinds of parliamentarian tricks. I guess I'd like to get the message to them, if I could, or have you do it. If they think this is going to be such a millstone around the Democrats' necks in the midterms, and that they're going to just win all these new seats because of the health care bill, I'd like to ask them to just get out of the way, step aside, and let it happen. You know, they seem to be kind of talking out of both sides of their mouth on it. If it's such a good deal for them, or going to be, they should just get out of the way and let it happen.
Hmm. Marvin Overby?
An interesting perspective from the caller, and you know, I think that there's some validity in his perspective. I personally believe that the Republican leadership in the House and Senate that they're not stupid, they're not misinformed necessarily, and that they probably share a perspective rather similar to mine that. They realize that if this bill gets passed, it is going to become part of the American social welfare network. And I think a number of them are sort of philosophically uncomfortable with that. And so the argument that it's going to be bad for Democrats is just sort of one of their arguments. They also just don't like this as a matter of principle, and they don't want to see it passed. And I think they realize that if it is passed, it or some version of it is going to be here to stay. And you know, to the extent that they study history, they probably understand that similar arguments were made against Social Security, were made against Medicare, and were made in other countries, like the national health system in Great Britain. And even Margaret Thatcher was unable to roll much of that back when she was a conservative prime minister in the 1980s. Once programs like this get passed, they become popular with the public. For good or for ill, they become very difficult then to change. And I think that at least among more reflective Republicans, that's what they're concerned about. They're concerned more about sort of the long-term policy and philosophical implications of this than they are necessarily about the 2010 vote, although they're probably concerned about both.
No matter what happens in the coming weeks, it's been an ugly process to watch. And I wonder, did something go monstrously wrong here with Obama's plan to pursue health care reform? Or was this just bound to be a long, bloody battle where nobody got to walk away without a scar?
I think it's more the latter, Veronica. The Obama administration was asking the American political process to take on a fairly major, fairly comprehensive change, and that is essentially not the way the American system works. With our system of separation of powers, with our system of federalism, with our system of a bicameral legislature with the House and the Senate, it is very, very difficult to sort of bring all the forces into play to pass major pieces of reform in a short period of time. There are too many choke points, right, where some group or some constellation of groups, even sometimes small minorities, can block legislation from happening. And that's what we've seen here. I personally think, and I know this sort of cuts against the zeitgeist of the times, I personally think that the process being more open makes it more difficult to get sort of comprehensive legislation like this passed, because the public does not like the politicking that has always been and always will be, I think, a part and parcel of making laws in a democratic society. They don't like the vote trading. They don't like the use of rules. They don't like the back and forth. They don't like the bickering. And I think that as our process has become more open in the last couple of generations, that openness makes it more difficult, not easier, to get this sort of legislation passed.
Do you think it was a good move to go for this right after he took office?
I think it was his only opportunity. If he wanted to do it, that was the time. Political scientists talk about, you know, the virtues of hitting the ground running, that after an election, especially when you get a sort of a new party coming into power, the opposition is in something of disarray. There's no natural spokesman for the party. And, you know, we've seen a bit of that. There's no natural spokesman for the Republican opposition right now. And, you know, President Obama was riding very high in the public opinion polls. He's still relatively high in the public opinion polls. And he realized, I think, that sort of what, regardless of what happened during the first 2 years of his administration, he was likely to lose seats in the House and probably lose seats in the Senate. So that if he wanted to make a play for this sort of reform, he needed to do it early. What I think they weren't necessarily counting on, and what they had to deal with as, and then sort of delayed this process, was the broader world financial situation, which, as a matter of necessity, forced them to take some of their attention away from health care, forced them to focus on other matters for a while, and that sort of put them back a bit. I think they would have moved earlier on health care under normal situations, and I think they would have been politically wise to do so.
We're coming into break again here, but I think we have time for one more call. How about Jim calling from Milwaukee? Welcome, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I want to talk to mom-and-pop conservatives about the approach of the top 1%, the corporate Republicans, in terms of their attitude towards taxes and debt and regulation. And, you know, in the Bible they talk about to whom much is given, much is required. But they don't want to be required to pay taxes or have regulation, but they're glad to receive the benefits from the system. So Mercury Marine will take benefits from the government, and promise 2,000 jobs and only provide 12. And Toyota will take perks, but they don't want regulation. And the Chicago Cubs want a facility built by the taxpayers in Arizona. So conservatives are selective. They don't want to do anything for the middle class or the working poor or the poor, but they'll take care of their own. And so they rob Peter to pay Paul, and they don't want to be held accountable in the court of public opinion. But if they do the crime, they should do the time. And so I just close by saying that for mom-and-pop conservatives, if you don't want to deal with this, I've got a solution for you. Go to a music store, buy a trumpet, take some lessons, and learn how to play taps for American democracy and the American way of life as we know it.
Marvin Overby.
Not sure there's a question there I have to respond to.
Right.
Yeah, you know, conservatives and liberals or progressives have different perspectives on this, and I think there is room in American society, I hope there's room in American society for people to disagree about things without necessarily being disagreeable or casting aspersions. Conservatives believe that you can help society at large best by lowering taxes, by giving people incentives to work harder, to save more, you know, there is. I think there is some evidence that in some situations that works. Conservatives tend to believe that people are responsible for their own situations. Liberals and progressives tend to think there's more social or societal responsibility. But again, I think we should be able to have a civil debate on this, to be able to talk about these matters without necessarily making sinners out of the other side. These are disagreements about ideas, I think, not necessarily disagreements about morality. I'm sympathetic to the notion that conservatives sometimes say this and do that, but liberals do the same thing. I think neither side, neither party, neither political orientation, neither ideological orientation sort of has cornered the market on virtue here.
Well, we'll leave it there as we go into our next break. As we talk all things political with Marvin Overby this morning, he's a professor and chair in political science at the University of Missouri. I'm Veronica Rickard in this morning for Kathleen Dunn, and we're taking your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. We can talk some more about health care reform if you like. We can also talk about some of the other issues out there right now, including the approval of 1,600 new homes for Jews in East Jerusalem. That was in the news lately. Some education reform stuff tacked on to the health care reform bills as well. Anyway, whatever you want to talk about, do give us a call this morning with your question and comment. 1-800-642-1234. Veronica Rickard back with you this Monday morning. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn for All Things Political. We're talking this morning with Marvin Overby, professor and chair in political science at the University of Missouri. Taking our next call now, Scott joining us from Green Bay. Welcome, Scott.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just have a couple of quick points about the health care situation. And I know everybody wants to rail on the Republicans, but that's really not the problem. The problem the president has is with his own party, because if it doesn't pass, it's going to be because of he can't garnish the votes within his own party. And that's point number one. Point number two is I'm a conservative, but I have a different perspective on health care. I think we should have universal coverage for everyone with a private option as opposed to doing it the opposite way, having a public option. I think we should be providing some basic level of service for everyone, then have a private option if you want better coverage. But people need to understand something. Everybody's got to pitch in and pony up. The rich, so-called rich, can't pay for everything. I know Democrats and liberals want the rich to pay for everything. They can't. If we're going to have universal coverage, everybody is going to have to contribute. That's point number one. Point number two is services will go down because we can't have the type of health service and coverage that we have in the United States and expect it to be somewhat free. So there will have to be rationing. I don't have a problem with that, but there will have to be some rationing. You can't have Taj Mahals for hospitals anymore. I travel to Germany every year, so I've been in some of the medical facilities there, and they're nothing like, I mean, it's great coverage and great care, but they're nothing like the services we have. I mean, there's been a lot of dishonesty when it comes to this topic. And point number three is a perfect example of that is covering pre-existing conditions. You can't insure pre-existing conditions. That's a misnomer. You can subsidize pre-existing conditions, but you can't insure pre-existing conditions because somebody has a pre-existing condition, it will occur again, and you will subsidize their treatment. So there's just a lot of dishonesty when it comes to the health debate, and it should be an open and honest debate.
Okay, well, thank you for your call, Scott. Marvin Overby?
Yeah, I largely agree with the caller. One of the things that's gotten lost in this in the debate we've had about these proposed reforms is that there does need to be some sort of societal discussion about the trade-offs we're willing to accept. And I'm not an expert on healthcare and not an expert on health economics, but it seems to me that the caller's basic point is essentially correct, and that is that you can have really good top-end sort of state-of-the-art gold-plated coverage for a smaller number of people, or you can take those same resources and redistribute them somewhat and provide more comprehensive but more basic coverage for more people. The difficulty is that we don't tend to treat healthcare coverage like we do other items we purchase in the marketplace. We don't tend to sort of fix a marginal cost to them. We are unlikely to say when our wife or our daughter or a mother or a father is dying, we're unlikely to say, you know, I think I can do without the six CD player in this model of the car. We want someone to throw as many resources at trying to cure that problem, even if it's essentially incurable, as is available. And so I believe, again, the caller's right. To have the kind of health care that you see in essentially most of the other advanced industrial democracies we're going to have some sort of rationing. And the American public is sort of averse to rationing like that sort being run through some sort of government agency. For better or worse, we seem more comfortable with running it through private insurance companies based on, you know, what is sort of cynically called the wallet biopsy. But, yeah, I think that we have, to a certain extent, missed an opportunity over this debate, in this political debate, to have that sort of deeper and more meaningful debate about what we would like our health care to be.
Do you think we'll get to that later, maybe in a fine-tuning stage?
I don't know. I sort of doubt it. And it's because I think we don't want to face some of the realities that's involved there. And the reality is, as the caller suggested, we are going to have to consider some other forms of rationing of health care. And most of us do not want to sort of face that really hard choice, that really hard language, when it comes to our own loved ones who would be rationed out, who wouldn't get, you know, the liver transplant, or who wouldn't get the end of life sort of emergency radical procedures that have little chance of success, but you always think that your loved one will be one of the few who actually benefits. And sort of we're unwilling to talk about and to discuss and to make rationing decisions like that. And I don't think we're anywhere close to being there yet.
Well, in a way, it's hard to discuss those things because we don't know what it means yet. We haven't had any experience yet. So in the immediate present, it's all kind of hypothetical.
Right. And I'm not sure there's anything in the current health care bill, this reform, that is going to force that. I just don't see it. It is true that I think we're not exactly sure how these proposals would actually work on the ground. But I don't think we're anywhere near the point, like you are again in most advanced industrial democracies, where you have that sort of rationing, those sort of rationing decisions being made.
Let's take our next call from Al in Bayfield. Hi, Al.
Yeah. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Just a note. My one of my sons is a graduate of Mizzou Journalism School from a few years back. So I always have good feelings about people who appear from Missouri. Question for your guest. I'm going to ask him to project a little bit into the future, look at the midterm elections. Whether or not health care passes, I think there seems to be agreement that the Democrats are probably going to pay a price in the midterms. Let's assume that they lose their majority in the House. I don't know what may happen in the Senate, but in the House, would you expect the Democrats then being a minority party to play the same kind of obstructionist role that the Republicans have played since the Obama election?
Good to hear about successful Mizzou alums. And the short answer to your question is yes. I don't actually think at this point that the Democrats are going to lose control of either chamber in the Congress. I think there's probably a likely pickup of seven Senate seats, which would move the chamber from a 59-41 to a 52-48 split. And, you know, we're going to see somewhere between 16 and 30-something House seats likely change parties. But the House Democrats have a sizable 70-something seat majority right now. I just don't see the Republicans being able to pick up either chamber right now. And, you know, it's important to sort of keep some context here. The majority party almost always loses seats in a midterm election. And that is even more true, I think, for Democrats who tend to come in with higher sort of promises and higher expectations. And they get punished more, I think, for not meeting those expectations. But as I said earlier in the program, there are some indications out there that this may not be as good a year for Republicans as some of the more partisan members of the GOP would like. If you look at House retirement rates, which is a fairly good indication of sort of which party has the wind at its back, I think the last time I checked, there had been 34 House members had either resigned, retired, or announced their retirement. And that's a pretty high number for this point in time. But right now, they're evenly split between Democrats and Republicans. So Democrats who should be retiring at higher rates than Republicans because they're facing sort of uncertain electoral fortunes in 2010, they're really not. And this continues to be sort of a problem for Republicans in that they sometimes have a difficult time convincing their members to stick around and to keep running for reelection. And that means that they're going to have to divert some resources from seats that should be defended by incumbents into these open seats that are going to be opened up by the Republicans' retirements. It's also, I think, important to notice that Barack Obama's popularity numbers still remain reasonably good, right? I checked the latest pollster.com average of averages showed him with a 52% favorable, 42% unfavorable rate, 47% approval, 49% disapproval. Now, that's 20-some points ahead of where George W. Bush was in the last year of his presidency. This is a party that still has some considerable appeal. If you look at party identification in the public, you see the same thing. 8% Democratic advantage, right? 33% identify themselves as Democrat, 25% as Republican. So, the generic congressional ballot, when you ask people, you know, are you more likely to vote for a Republican or a Democrat for Congress in 2010, right now it's essentially tied. So I think that some of the gloom and doom we've heard and on the Democratic side and some of the glee on the Republican side, it remains a bit premature.
Well, changing focus just a little bit, Professor Overby, can you tell us a little bit about the overhaul of student loan programs that's been tacked onto the health care bill?
Oh boy, that's not something I know much about. I should, since I have a student, I have a daughter in college, but I really don't know much about it.
Well, I know that they're trying to have the government give directly to the students instead of through private institutions, and an expansion of the Pell Grant program there as well.
Right.
So I guess the question is, does that rise and fall with the bill?
I don't know. One of the things I've learned out of being in the classroom for 20 years is when I don't know the answer to a question, just go ahead and hit it.
Fess up.
Yeah, I fess up. I don't know. It's not something I followed, and I'm not sure I've got an informed opinion about that.
Okay, well, let's take another call then. We've got Richard with us from Cudahy. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a little confused. Where you keep hearing that if this health care bill is passed, that insurance premiums will most likely go down. What makes people or the government think that insurance premiums are going to go down? I keep thinking, going back to this credit card bill that was passed, where the bill was passed in, I believe it was October. It went into effect in February. And in the meantime, the credit card companies doubled and tripled their interest rates. What's preventing the insurance companies from doing the same thing with health care?
And Marvin Overby?
I'm not sure I've got a good answer to that. And, you know, the caller's concerns may be well-founded. I mean, that is oftentimes what you see when you have a new sort of regulation going to effect, is that the companies that are going to be affected, whether it's, you know, a ban on putting up billboards beginning at a certain time on a highway or credit card rates, they rush in quickly to sort of put up the billboards or to raise the rates before the new regulations go into place. So we may well see that. I think that, the goal of the bill is, among other things, is to try to limit the kind of increases that the Californians are seeing with their Blue Cross Blue Shield programs. Whether it's going to be effective or not, you know, is something that a bit remains to be seen. The problem, as the old saying goes, with making things foolproof is that fools are such an ingenious lot, and they find ways around the rules that are put in place. That's one reason why this bill is going to be 2,700 pages long, is because the people who are writing the bills, the lawyers who are writing it, are trying to anticipate what the lawyers on the other side are going to do once the bill becomes law. So I don't know. We'll see.
Professor Overby, we've only got about 30, 35 seconds for your answer, but I'm wondering, as a side point, how you think Rahm Emanuel is going to be weathering this whole process?
I don't know. He's, you know, he's sort of the, in some sense, the president's alter ego. He's the hard-nosed, taken by the throat sort. I don't know. We've gotten some interesting insights into sort of the workings of the Obama administration, the Obama White House. I think there is a virtue to having someone like a Rahm Emanuel around, who is, you know, something of the throat cutter, something of the hatchet man. We'll see.
Well, we'll leave it there, and we're wishing you a good rest of your week. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Marvin Overby, a professor and chair in political science at the University of Missouri. He was a regular guest during All Things Political with Kathleen Dunn. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in this week, or rather just today, for Kathleen Dunn. She'll be back with you again tomorrow. If you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program 315D. Hope you'll stay tuned to Wisconsin Public Radio. We've got a lot more coming up right after a look at the news. Thanks.